Well, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. It's good to be back with you all. We had, Sue and I had one fantastic trip. We were on a cruise to Alaska. And how many of you have ever been on a cruise? Anybody been? Oh, a bunch of you. Okay. Well, I was on another one a while ago. And I tell you the truth, it was a short cruise and I didn't like it. I'll tell you why. I felt like I was in a shopping mall and I couldn't escape. Water to the left of me, water to the right of me, water, you know. But this one was absolutely fabulous. And if I'm allowed to make a recommendation of a cruise company, let me tell you, Holland America, wow, wow. There's so many pleasant things about it, but I'm going to focus on just some insights and lessons that occurred to me through the trip. Hopefully, this will be meaningful to you. What we're talking about is the life well lived. That's the subject I want to raise. Or we could frame it as a question, what is the life well lived? Big subject, but some lessons did arise as I reflected on this wonderful experience. So let me share some things with you. Well, of course, it was our 50th anniversary trip. 50 years. Where did that go? Whoa! Actually, that was last May, but it took a while to get ready for this. So our 50th anniversary was this May 25th, but 51st, but you rounded off to the nearest 10. So it was really just absolutely wonderful. But I want to share a few things which struck me as I'm on the trip. And one was as follows. As I considered who was on the trip, it was 1,900 people on this boat. That's a big boat, you know. On top of that, 800 staff people, the most wonderful staff people. I mean, people principally from the Philippines, from Indonesia, and some from Malaysia and other places, the most polite, cheerful, helpful, competent people. But that's another story. What I did notice was that it was almost entirely people our age. Yeah. And this insight came to me, and I like to think it was from Hashem, that I was filled with a sense of admiration for all these people that we encountered, not encountered by talking to many, but just by being with them throughout the trip. And here's what I mean by that. The average age, again, I'm guessing, didn't take a poll, was between 60 and 80, right? And mostly, I noticed, husbands and wives, sometimes they seemed to have come as a group from one place. You know, you just sensed they'd be sitting at a table together and they all knew each other well. But these are people who, through life, had chosen to stick together, undoubtedly, because this is the way life is for us and everybody to one extent or another. There are moments that are tough. I'd have to say, actually, between Sue and me, there have been very few of those, almost none, thank God. But, you know, life is life, and things happen. And yet, my sense is that these are people, you could feel their rapport. They had husbands and wives. They liked being with each other. I even sensed that they weren't that thrilled with sitting with other strangers and striking up conversations. I think for many, and including us, this was a chance to just detach from the usual rhythms of life and endless conversations with everybody who, you know, I mean, all good stuff, don't get me wrong, but I sensed from the group that these couples just liked being together and just enjoyed that aspect. These people had raised their kids. Their kids were not with them. And they obviously had built careers, allowing them an occasional delightful experience, like a cruise. And the net result is that I came away with a profound sense of gratitude, or not gratitude, it's not the right word. There is that too, gratitude to God for the whole experience, but it wasn't gratitude principally, it was a sense of honor and appreciation for people who paid their dues in life, and at least to some extent can be said to to have discovered what a life well lived looks like. It's not a spiritual insight particularly, but I want to conclude with this later on within a larger framework of our Messianic Jewish experience. So that was the first thing, a sense of appreciation and honor for people who had lived into their 60s, 70s, and 80s and had paid a lot of dues, and here they were enjoying the fruits of a life at least relatively well lived. I don't know individual stories. It's just a broad generalization that I sensed. Now, I want to tell you a second reflection comes from a very special Jewish service we were at. This is not exactly a Jewish crowd. How do you know? You just know. And yet, not to take away anything from the sense of honor and respect that I came away with, but we learned that there was actually going to be a Jewish service on Friday night. Ah, okay, great. So we went, and we didn't know, you know, were we going to be the only ones there? Not quite. There was another couple in our age bracket, a Jewish family who lived in Florida. I won't say anything more specific about that, but, you know, our age. And they attended, it turns out, a conservative synagogue. And there they were, and they saw us, and it was like in the Frisco Kid Luntzman, if you know the Kid Luntzman. And then, of course, the inevitable question came up. Oh, where are you from? Boston. What shul do you go to? Congregation Ruach Israel. It is a Messianic Jewish synagogue. We are Jewish belief people who believe that Jesus is the Messiah of Israel. Listen, I'm not going to hide who I am under any circumstances, and was delighted to just tell him. But you can sense, particularly from the wife, oh. Right? But you got to give Holland America credit. They had challah, they had wine, and siddurim, gates of prayer, reform siddur, and all. So there we were in this special moment of praying Lecha Dodi and praying elements of the evening service. And the guy had a good voice, and I can sing, and all through he's saying, wow, that was great. I mean, I don't know exactly what he meant by that. The experience he was having and the fact that we knew the liturgy quite well. And he would say, well, can you suggest a song for such and such? And no problem. And they knew the song too. And there was this wonderful kesher. Kesher means connection. This sense of here we are, 1,900 people, minus four, everyone else is, you know, in the lounge with a piano player learning a wonderful thing. On another night, we would have enjoyed it, but singing 60 songs and recapturing the songs of their youth. Again, think about the age group, you know, Carly Simon and this and that. And that's what they were doing. But here we were praising the God of Israel together with the traditional liturgy. And you could just... we just had this magnificent experience of Jewish joy together. And, you know, what reminded me, now, tomorrow night, right, Sunday night, Rabbi Nathan will be leading a study in Acts chapter 2. I'll be doing the Ruth study. By all means, come tomorrow night. It's going to be a great evening, and we're gonna just enjoy Shavuot. But there's a passage that struck me, again, as I reflected while on the trip on this magnificent experience of sitting with these people, and we made Kiddush together and everything, and then we just said goodbye to each other. And I wonder what it's like for services for them in their own synagogue last night. How was the trip? It was great. We had a great time. We actually had a wild experience. We were with some Messianic Jews. I want to tell you, we were wrong about them. They're legit. I could just hear the conversation right now, right? And who knows? So a little bit of, speculation on my part, but I wouldn't be surprised. I think that stereotypes were affected, and not because we were trying to do anything to prove anything to anybody. We were just worshiping, and of course through Yeshua, although we didn't have Jewish liturgy or rather Messianic elements in the liturgy that we were doing, but in our hearts and minds, you know, this is where we're at. We believe in him, and that's all there is to it. Anyhow, this passage. So tomorrow night, when Rabbi Nathan leads us, I don't know if he'll spend a lot of time on this, but I just wanted to read a couple of the verses that suggest something about the experience I'm sharing. This is from Acts chapter 2, when the Spirit, the Ruach, fell on the Shlichim, the apostles, and all of a sudden, they spoke in or were heard in. It's a little difficult to tell from the text, it's miraculous one way or the other. They were heard in all these languages from disparate Jewish communities all over the Mediterranean area. And so it goes like this. First, a question was asked. Utterly amazed, they asked, aren't all these who were speaking Galileans, country bumpkins, you know? And then, how is it that each of us hears them in our native language? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, all the way to the east, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, like Turkey, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, in the west, and parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts, Jews by choice who became Jews, and there were some non-Jews there too, Cretans and Arabs. We hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own languages. And I thought, what a picture of a disparate group of Yids from all over coming together and hearing the word of Yeshua and having this unique experience. Well, for me, it was evocative of this time on this tour with this other couple and how delightful it was and just wonderful. So, let's move on to number three, the next insight. So that's number one. And now the next one. This is, again, just reflections while on a trip. They just occurred to me then, and I've been thinking about them and feeling it worthy to share with you about the life well lived. Okay. So I want to tell you a salmon story. I want to tell you about salmon. How many likes? Do you like salmon? Oh, my gosh, so yummy. I love salmon. Okay, so we visited, you're on the ship, and then they take you, it's the southeastern part of Alaska, and they take you from the bottom, and they take you through a waterway up toward different areas. We ended in Juneau, but one of the first places we visited was Ketchikan in Alaska. And Ketchikan is reputed to be the first city of the state of Alaska. Let me just tell you, Alaska, their biggest city is Anchorage. We started there, actually. And let me tell you, to them, it's a big city to us. You know what I mean? If you can find a McDonald's, don't say anything. If there's anyone in YouTube land from Ketchikan or from Alaska, no offense intended, but it's, you know, there aren't that many people there. Okay, so Ketchikan is considered the salmon capital of the world. And we learned a lot about salmon. And I want to tell you about the life journey of an Atlantic salmon. And it's very, very interesting. So where do salmon get born? They get born they're born in fresh water, and rivers, their moms would, it would be their eggs would be there, and they would be born in fresh water. And then, after they grow up a little bit, there are physiological chemical changes in their bodies which gradually prepare them for their journey to the sea, to salt water. This is an amazing thing. They go from fresh water to salt water. And so then they continue in living in salt water in time for them, after they've grown to adulthood, to swim back to the actual river they were born, though it might be hundreds of miles away. And there are speculations as to what allows this to occur. Some have said that it has something to do with the magnetic aspects of the magnetic nature of the magnetic field surrounding the Earth, and perhaps they somehow tune into that. Others suggest there's something, some subtlety in the environment in which they were born, that they were able to somehow navigate their way. But don't you find that miraculous, or in a general, not the strict sense miraculous as part of the physical world, but don't you find that amazing? And I want to tell you about the journey. You see, they can travel back up to 1,000 kilometers. I imagine kilometers 5/8 of a mile. So anyhow, hundreds and hundreds of miles, and somehow they're able to, from the ocean, find their way back to the place that they were born. And salmon have special muscles adapted for this kind of journey, muscles that give them the ability for short, explosive action, like quick twitch muscles we talk about that people have. And they're able to jump 10 feet in the air from swimming, jump because they have to go up waterfalls many times. They can jump out of the water as high as 10 feet. And waiting at the top, we saw pictures of this. We didn't see actual bears there, but there's pictures of bears right at the top of the waterfall, standing on rocks with their mouths open. What do you think they're doing? Come here, little fishies, right? And so the jumping right into the mouths of all these bears. In other words, it's a very treacherous journey, as you can imagine. But ultimately, they arrive back, and they have become so depleted of their fat sources and their energy that they spawn their young, and they die. Right? All the effort given to do this one thing of seeing to it that the next generation continues. All right. Now, what does this have to do with Messianic Jewish anything? Well, let me tell you. Quiz question. I wonder if anyone knows this. What is the Hebrew word for fish? Does anyone know? Dag. That's right. All right, smarties. What is the Aramaic word? Does anyone know? I know, I bet Rabbi Nathan knows, but I'm not going to ask him. It's noon. Noon. Okay? In Aramaic, fish is noon. Well, what's very interesting is that there are a few sections of the Torah which have something called, some people call it upside down noons, others call it reversing noons. Now, when noon looks like this, let me see if I can give it from your angle, a noon. Okay, I'm going to just do this. It goes like this and like that. That's all. Almost looks like a bracket, okay? And the reversing noon, the way it works in this passage is that the noons face outward rather than facing inward toward each other, and there's a rabbinic midrashic understanding of that. I won't get into that particular one. I'll share it with you at Simcha Torah, so I will share it with you. But there's something about it I wanted to stress with you. We're talking about the journey and the reversing or upside down noons. And here is a passage in the Torah which prominently displays the reversing noons. That is, they're not in the Hebrew text the way you'd normally expect. And tell me if this is familiar to you. We stand when the Torah is returned to the ark, and what do we say? Right from the Torah. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee from before you." And when it rested, he would say, "Return, O Lord, to the 10,000s of Israel." Sound familiar? Yeah, like a few minutes ago. That's exactly what we intoned. Now, this passage of the Torah is glorious. God, you're going before us. We're returning the Torah to the ark as we did in ancient days. We return, or the Torah led us forward in victory. But what's interesting is that immediately following this passage in the Torah are chapter after chapter of all the struggles we face getting to Eretz Yisrael. I mean, right afterwards, all the accounts of us complaining and Moses being mad at us and God threatening to wipe us out and all those kind of things. In other words, the whole thing after this triumphant beginning, the rest of it is struggle, 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 struggle. And so a rabbinic commentary is, well, the Jews are like a noon, Aramaic for fish. The Jewish experience is one of really having to give yourself to it for a higher purpose, like the salmon who gives us all, and that is the nature of the Jewish, and it would include the Messianic Jewish experience, filled with glorious things, tough at times too, the nature of it, okay. Now, all of this, I think, is helpful to us in thinking about the life well lived. The life well lived is the life of a committed life. And I feel badly, and I say this with compassion, I say this with, you know, if you've had experiences in life which prevent you from keep being intimate and connected with people, prevent you from committing to other people in love, a community in love, then it's a sad thing. But the good news is, with God's help, you can work counter to those impulses, and you can find the best kind of life to live in connection with others. And again, the example here from our trip is just all these salmon for the highest purpose of spawning their young and seeing to it that there's another generation. They give it their all, they do it together, and you have the rabbinic insight. Okay, now we're getting close to the end here. I would like to share with you the conclusion. Where are we going with all this? As we celebrate Shavuot tomorrow night, and then Monday morning too, gang, okay, and we need you here for a minyan, so very important. I encourage everyone to think about the idea, again, of the life well lived, and what this can mean to you on your journey. And I'd like to read to you a passage, and I believe I have it here, I should have. Let me just summarize. It's Yeshua. He epitomizes what in the natural world is the salmon's journey of absolute self-sacrifice for the sake of others, that is, the future generations. And I'd like us just to think for a moment, I won't quote it now, but you know the passage, of Yeshua in the garden at Gethsemane. You'll recall that after the Pesach Seder, and they sang the Hallel, you know, they did the stuff, the basic liturgy of the Pesach, and they went to this garden in Jerusalem, the Garden of Oil Presses, if you the literal meaning. And there Yeshua told his followers, wait here, I'm going to go pray. And while he's praying, he says, he pleads, God, if it's possible, take this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. Now, what he was thinking about was the inevitability of his own crucifixion, which is one of the most psychologically and physically horrific ways to die you can possibly imagine. We've talked about that at other times. And he reflecting, because he was not just an expression of God's very reality, he was God's son in the most profound sense, but he was also a person, a regular guy. And in this moment where the natural human desire for self-preservation and to avoid pain was facing the inevitability of what he knew he had to do to make Kippurah for Israel. And it is, to me, in the world of salmon, It's a vague intimation, but yet nonetheless, I think is hardwired into the fabric of God's revelation to humanity of what the good life, the best life is. It includes, it doesn't necessarily include horrific things, but it includes things that are tough that you transcend and you do for higher purposes. And every one of you and me, we've all got our stories, but God is saying, I think to us this morning, be thinking about the highest life being one of reward for a job well done, but also the willingness to do the tough thing because that's Messiah's example to us. And then how does it all end? I conclude with a few thoughts about, or a few verses about Abraham Avinu. Abraham lived 75 years, and Abraham breathed his last and died at a good old age, an old man and full of years, and he was gathered to his people, and his son Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre, in the field of Ephron, son of Zohar the Hittite, the field Abraham had bought from the Hittites. There Abraham was buried with his wife Sarah. After Abraham's death, God blessed his son Isaac, who then lived near Lahai-Lor-I. And so as we celebrate tomorrow night and Monday morning, as we celebrate Shavuot, I just want to encourage you to think about what a life well-lived looks like, what it's supposed to look like, what it can look like, and may we all, in little ways and big ways, make decisions to live that life, which at the end we look back and go, you know, that was good. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. In the mouths of the house of Israel, and may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.